This is a reading of The Spiritual Beings in the Heavenly Bodies and in the Kingdoms of Nature, a cycle of 10 lectures given in Helsinki, April 3rd to the 14th, 1912, by Rudolf Steiner, with four additional lectures, two private addresses to Russian members, and two public lectures for in those four additionals. This is a newer edition of this. It has an introduction by Renée Querida, which I am going to read. So this is the introduction by Renée Querida. With the passage of time, Rudolf Steiner's immense contribution to the renewal of art, science, and religion, and to the practical applications of spiritual science has gained increased significance. Within less than two decades, at the beginning of this century, Steiner laid the foundation for the teaching of anthroposophy in two main endeavors. Firstly, between 1900 and 1909, he wrote the five basic books, of which Occult Science in Outline is the most comprehensive. Secondly, he traveled widely, covering almost every corner of Europe, bringing to larger and sometimes smaller audiences the basic thoughts of the new science of the spirit. During this period of tireless travel, with Berlin as his headquarters, Steiner would often visit eight or nine countries per year. What came about was virtually a traveling university. He would lecture in Holland, Switzerland, Norway, Austria, Italy, Hungary, England, Czechoslovakia, Finland, Sweden, and in many cities of Germany. Apart from addressing local members, a fairly extensive group of friends, having taken time off from their regular activities, would follow him from place to place. Some 50 courses, each comprising about 10 lectures each, were held in this manner between 1906 and 1918. It is within this context that we have to consider the Helsinki cycle of lectures that is here being reprinted. Rudolf Steiner arrived in the Finnish capital by boat a few days before Easter in 1912. A number of friends from Scandinavia and Germany accompanied him. There was a special sense of expectation in the air, for this was Rudolf Steiner's first visit to Finland. Russian members had hoped that he would visit them in St. Petersburg, but as the Russian authorities had refused him a visa, they came to Helsinki in order to participate in the course. From all accounts, there was a festive Easter mood. Rudolf Steiner attended a traditional Russian Orthodox Easter Mass. He also shared a typical Easter meal with the Russian friends. Margarita Voloshin in Die grüne Schlange, that is the green snake, vividly describes this event. Quote, "After we had taken our seats around the table, Steiner cut the Easter loaf in the form of a hexagon, divided it among us, rose, and held an address. The content of this was as follows. Subquote, "The whole history of humankind is the entombment of the Godhead. With our consciousness, we can only celebrate the entombment on Good Friday. We cannot understand Easter with our ordinary reasoning powers. We can celebrate Easter only to the extent that we commit ourselves to tread the path of the Spirit." End quote. These words were spoken with great earnestness. Full end quote. A few days later, Rudolf Steiner invited the Russian members to a gathering at the hotel where he was staying in the heart of Helsinki. They crowded into one of the guest rooms and received a special message. "This address, unique in Rudolf Steiner's work, is here published for the first time in English." A second address followed a year later on the occasion of Rudolf Steiner's second visit, again only imparted to Russian members. Brackets, "It is also included for the first time in English in the present volume." Brackets. Both lectures contain unusual material, and Margarita Voloshin reported that she had never heard Steiner speak with such inwardness. He spoke, quote, "He spoke so personally to each one, and it seemed as if each word was imbued with endless warmth, which he sought to implant in our souls. He spoke of the young soul of the Russian people, of which one can become conscious in the spiritual worlds, and which was not able as yet to reveal itself. He showed us the path to our own folk soul, and how important that was for the future." End quote. When reading these lectures today, we find that they contain an unusually prophetic element. Steiner graphically describes the role of Russia between two mighty temptations, the material decadence of the West and the vague mysticism of the East. English-speaking readers will be interested not only in the many references to both England and America, but also in the quite remarkable characterization of the forces that flow into Russia from Asia. In the second address, we find the following poignant remark, quote, "You have found it possible, in spite of the great difficulties that prevail in your country, to assemble here unhindered. make use of this opportunity to achieve the greatest possible inward relatedness among you, in order to build the bridge between each one of you and your folk soul." Unquote. Strange as it may seem initially that Rudolf Steiner chose to speak to the Russian separately, some 80 years later we are now better able to understand why the particular and intimate messages contained in these lectures were not available even in the original German form until the late '60s. During this first visit to England, to Finland, Rudolf Steiner also gave a public lecture on the nature of national epics, with special reference to the Kalevala, which too is included for the first time in English in the present collection. This particular lecture opens up a very significant aspect in Steiner's work. He rediscovered the importance of this Finnish epic as one of the great poems, not only of national importance, but for the whole of humanity. The Kalevala, which had lived strongly in the oral tradition among the people of Finland, was collected by Elilas Lonrot, 1802-1884, a district physician, on his extended excursions in the rural parts of Karelia. Lonrot roamed thousands of miles on foot, by boat and by horse cart, carrying with him writing equipment and a flute, which at times he played at weddings or village celebrations. By 1845 he had made 11 long journeys collecting material. In the course of the next few years he continued this activity, gathering incantations and poems from simple people still endowed with great spirituality and a remarkably accurate memory of age-old oral traditions. Rudolf Steiner commented on the importance of this mythological heritage and showed its relevance to our own time and for the future. To Herbert Hahn, one of the original Waldorf teachers, Rudolf Steiner pointed out that in the future the Kalevala would have a cultural influence as profound as the works of Homer have had in the world for over 2,000 years. In 1914, 2 years after the first Helsinki visit, Rudolf Steiner gave a series of 3 lectures on the Kalevala, thus launching a revival of interest in one of the greatest epics of all humankind. These were given in Dornach, Novembers 9th, 14th, and 15th of 1914. It is worthwhile to note that the powerful music of Jean Sibelius and the arresting paintings of Akseli Galenkelela both contributed a great deal to a growing interest in the Kalevala. Inspired by creative Finnish anthroposophists, the mighty poem has recently been performed for large audiences in southern Finland in festivals featuring music, recitation, and drama. This has become a major national cultural event. Depending on the location and the nature of the audience, Rudolf Steiner's lectures varied immensely in tone, style, and content. Speaking to Scandinavians and Finnish members, Rudolf Steiner was particularly sensitive to the fact that the people of the North still have an immediate relationship to the weaving and working in nature of elemental beings that has largely been lost in other parts of Europe. The cycle of lectures reprinted here entitled The Spiritual Beings in the Heavenly Bodies and in the Kingdoms of Nature opens with a sensitive contemplation of various phenomena that are easily accessible to every human being. It begins with a consideration of the blue sky, then describes the green of trees bursting into leaf and the green of the meadows, and finally offers a contemplation of the white snow mantle that covers the earth in winter. Rudolf Steiner guides his listeners to an impression of how such meditative observations of nature can be transmuted into inner moral feelings. This he shows to be a gradual, stage-by-stage path to experience, and he shows how the threshold from the physical to the supersensible is crossed, in order to commute first with the elemental beings, and then with the hierarchies in their ascending ranks and functions throughout the cosmos. The 10 lectures are permeated by a mighty symphonic sweep, leading us from the lowliest to the highest in nature and the universe. In the final lectures, the cosmic Christ is revealed in this lofty vision. A culmination is reached at the end of the last lecture, quote, "Thus, through true heavenly science, something uniform is brought to the human beings, and this will promote the intellectual and moral understanding of humanity on earth. We do not wish to consider merely the abstract and theoretical, but every such consideration ought to become in us a source of moral power." Unquote. In view of the renewed interest in angelology, it might not be inappropriate to include in this introduction a brief survey on the teachings of the celestial beings throughout history. The earliest systematic mention is found in the writings of Dionysius the Areopagite, a disciple of St. Paul, who lived in the 1st century A.D. The authenticity of these documents and their author has been fiercely disputed from the 9th century A.D. right into our own time, some scholars purporting them to be the work of a pseudo-Dionysus who incorporated Neoplatonic, Christian, Gnostic, Judaic, and even ancient Indian elements. It should be borne in mind that the writings on the divine names and the celestial hierarchies only appeared at the turn of the 5th and 6th centuries A.D. The question is justified. How could they have been written by Dionysus the Areopagite, the pupil and friend of St. Paul? Rudolf Steiner offers an elucidation that goes to the very heart of the matter. The teachings of Dionysus the Areopagite were given by word of mouth to a small group of chosen pupils and included the practice of a meditative path leading to deification, a path by means of which the neophyte could become, through catharsis and enlightenment, a conscious co-creator with the gods. These teachings and practices were closely guarded in the first esoteric school of Christianity, instituted by St. Paul in Athens, and guided by Dionysus the Areopagite for many decades. None of the content was written down. Powers of memory were still strong enough to ensure an accurate oral transmission through esoteric circles up to the 5th and 6th centuries. But as these powers began to wane, it became necessary to commit these teachings to a written form, except for the meditative path toward deification, that is, becoming like God, which remained closely guarded for centuries. In fact, Rudolf Steiner pointed out that it is only now, since the Age of Light began in 1899, that the truth's canon should be fully revealed. One of the tasks of anthroposophy is to make the reality of heavenly beings and the meditative practice leading to actual experience of them available to anyone wishing to tread this path to full consciousness. To the modern mind, wide open to any and all ideas, it may seem strange that the practice of the path was surrounded by such secrecy. We need to remember that, especially since the establishment of the Roman Church in the 4th century A.D., the idea that human beings could become like unto God out of their own inmost striving, without the intercession of the Church, was regarded as totally heretical. The concept of deification was to be uprooted energetically. It survived in the heretical and mystical streams of the Middle Ages, such as the Grail, the School of Chartres, the Cathars, and the Templar movement, to name but a few. But who was Dionysus the Areopagite? Legend tells us that this gifted young Athenian, an ardent student of Plato's writings, was in Heliopolis, the ancient Egyptian mystery center, when the events in Golgotha took place. He witnessed the darkening of the sun and experienced the earthquake on Good Friday as the Christ went through death. These events moved him to the core of his being, but they remained a riddle to him. Dionysus returned to Athens, and as his surname, the Areopagite, suggests, he was elected to the prestigious circle of judges that conferred regularly on the hill of Mars. Some 14 years later, St. Paul preached on this hill, revealing the nature of the Christ who had gone through death and resurrection. Dionysus was present and deeply moved. He now understood what he had experienced from a great distance at the time of the crucifixion to be a turning point in the development of humanity. In the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, an autobiography in Syriac is preserved which describes these events. It also relates that Dionysus sent to fetch the notes he had made in Egypt regarding the crucifixion, which were publicly read and found to agree with St. Paul, both as to the day and the hour. The manuscript states that St. Paul's visit to Athens took place 14 years after Dionysus's experience of the darkening of the sun in Egypt, which would place the conversion of Dionysus in A.D. 44, see the works of Dionysus the Areopagite, translated by John Parker, 1897. In the Acts of the Apostles, we find mention of Paul's visit to Athens and the reaction it brought forth. Quote, "Now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, but others said, subquote, we will hear you again about this, end subquote. But some joined him, Paul, and believed, among them Dionysus the Areopagite, a woman named Damaris, and others with them, end full quote, Acts 17:30-33. Parenthesis for further details regarding the life of Dionysus, see The Golden Age of Sharp by R. M. Querido, Hudson, New York, 1987. Parenthesis. As a result of this remarkable meeting between Paul and Dionysus, an esoteric school was founded whose influence flowed through the whole of Christendom for centuries. Whereas St. Paul traveled extensively, proclaiming the Christ, Dionysus remained until past 90 years of age in Athens, teaching small circles of students. Rudolf Steiner pointed out in a cycle of lectures entitled Theosophy of the Rosicrucian that the Rosicrucian spiritual path was already prepared in remote pre-Christian times. Quote, "It took on a particular configuration through the great initiate Dionysus the Areopagite, who founded the school of St. Paul in Athens, from which all later esoteric wisdom and training has sprung." Lecture 14, end of quote. The influence of these writings was indeed momentous, and shaped much of the deepest thought of the leading scholars and masters of the Middle Ages. In the 9th century, Charles the Bald summoned John Scotus Erigena to his court in Paris, so that he might translate the works of Dionysus into Latin. As a result, these documents became more readily available. A couple of centuries later, the 9-fold celestial hierarchies were made visible in sculptural form on the south porch of Chartres Cathedral. Abundant commentaries began to appear by such masters as John of Salisbury, Bishop of Chartres, Thomas Aquinas, and Albertus Magnus of Paris. It is estimated that in the work of Thomas Aquinas no fewer than 1,700 references to Dionysus the Areopagite can be found. Around 1300 AD, the mystical religious insight into the working of the divine hierarchies is translated into the imagery of Dante's majestic poem, The Divine Comedy. One has the impression, on reading the Paradise, that not only did Dante know about the hierarchies, but that he had experienced them in a mighty vision. Pico della Mirandola, famous as one of the outstanding minds of the Renaissance despite his youth, also held the works of Dionysus the Areopagite in high regard. However, during the Reformation, the fiercest opposition against Dionysus reared its head. Luther and Erasmus looked upon him as an arrogant, idle dreamer. By the 16th century, humanity had lost the connection with the guiding spirits of the hierarchies. Even the tradition had eroded, and soon materialism was to take over and sweep aside a spiritual view of the universe. In his work, The Heavenly Hierarchies, Dionysus the Areopagite leads us downward from the loftiest spiritual beings of the first hierarchy, seraphim, cherubim, and thrones, through the ranks of the second hierarchy to those of the third, closest yet superior in faculty to the human kingdom. We find many references to Hebrew traditions in Dionysus's work, alluding to the fact that Michael became the leader of the Jewish people, so that the providence of God in the incarnation of Christ Jesus might be fulfilled. Each hierarchical being is described in turn with its function and relationship to the whole of the divine world, and special mention is accorded the rank of the angels. For as the angels are the celestial beings closest to earthly humanity, presumably we may be able to fathom their influence more readily. Understandably, Dionysus's treatment of the hierarchies does not include a description of their influences in the kingdoms of nature and in the human being. This work still springs from an earlier clairvoyance, before the time had come for this to be revealed. It fell to Rudolf Steiner, as the first spiritual scientist of the New Age of Light, to proclaim the relationship between macrocosm and microcosm, the heavenly worlds and the kingdoms of nature. He embarked on this very early, and literally thousands of references are to be found in his work, both in books and lectures, over the course of some 21 years, from 1904 to 1925. Characteristically, as in the present cycle, Steiner usually describes the working of the hierarchies from below upward, starting with the third hierarchy and its three ranks of angels, archangels, and archai. Modern initiation has its starting point where we are, standing at the threshold between angel and beast. The diagram on the following page may be helpful, parenthesis in view of the fact that the hierarchies were given different names in accordance with the various languages, several of these different forms are included, parenthesis. The threefold hierarchical world, parenthesis each comprising beings of three ranks, parenthesis, interpenetrates the three kingdoms of nature with a human being at the center. And this is a description of this. At the top it says first hierarchy, which is seraphim, or spirits of love, cherubim, or spirits of harmony, thrones, or spirits of will. Now the second hierarchy, curiosities, or spirits of wisdom, also called dominions by Dionysus. Dunamis, or spirits of movement, also called mites or virtues by Dionysus. Exousiae, or spirits of form, also called powers. The third hierarchy, archai, or spirits of personality, also called principalities by Dionysus. Archangels, or folk spirits, also called fire spirits. Angels, or messengers, also called sons of life or of twilight. And then there is the human being, and then below the animal, then the plant, and then the mineral as the three kingdoms. The cosmic Christ, one of the Trinity, descended through the ranks of the hierarchies to become man on earth as Christ Jesus, so that human beings might become co-creators with the gods for the future kingdoms of nature. But we need to learn step by step, gradually, to achieve this goal in full consciousness. With love, we are indeed responsible for the future of our planet. The idea of deification, first formulated by Dionysus the Areopagite, can receive a new dimension in our time. We cannot become co-creators with the gods unless we know the overall plan of the hierarchies in creating the cosmos, and our planet in particular. A final point. When Rudolf Steiner was asked how one could counter the one-sided mechanistic view of the universe so prevalent today, he indicated that an active understanding of the working of the heavenly hierarchies and the kingdoms of nature in the human being and in the universe could act as a powerful corrective. This is in GA 193, Berlin, the 12th of September, 1919, parentheses. We may also recall that when Occult Science was published in 1909, it bore the subtitle, An Outline. The present cycle of lectures, along with many others given in different parts of Europe, may be considered an elaboration, especially of Chapter 4, quote, The Evolution of the Cosmos and the Human Being, unquote. Study of the present Helsinki course on the spiritual beings is eminently suited to help overcome the Ahrimanic influence that we are all subject to. The publishers should be commended on this new edition. The earnest hope is that many students of spiritual science and groups throughout the English-speaking world will take full advantage of the opportunity to contribute to the healing influence provided in such a powerful way by the cycle of lectures. That's the end of René Kurido's introduction.